This is Audible.
Christianity Before Christ. Written by John G. Jackson. Foreword by Frank Zindler. Narrated by Richard Webb. Copyrighted by American Atheist Press. This audiobook is published by arrangement with American Atheist Press and was produced in the year 2020 by Echo Point Books and Media, LLC, which holds the copyright there too. Foreword. John G. Jackson's Christianity Before Christ has always been one of the best-selling titles offered by American Atheist Press. It is a much-loved atheist classic that has been reprinted many times over the years. It is a work that the author always sought to improve and bring into line with the best-informed scholarly opinion of his day. Unfortunately, the death of the author in the mid-1990s, shortly before the deaths of the Murray O'Hares, the first family of American atheism, froze the book in its present form, with no possibility of his issuing an improved edition more accurately reflecting the evolved scholarly opinion of the 21st century. When the stockpile of books ran out in 2001, it became my responsibility to decide if American Atheist Press should reprint the book, decline to reprint the book, or issue a mutilated new edition in which each outdated opinion would be footnoted with detailed references to the latest findings and theories relating to each point. The long-enduring popularity of Christianity Before Christ ruled out of bounds the option of just letting the book die. On the other hand, the amount of research that would be needed to check out the latest scholarly opinion concerning every page of the book would impossibly overload an already overworked editor and render ugly a book that so many have loved for so long. Fortunately, almost all the points now being called into question concern the precise antiquity of Egyptian and other African cultural developments, as well as scholarly understanding of the origins and purposes of the Giza pyramids. And of course, our understanding of the evolutionary timetable has become much more precise since Jackson wrote this book. According to the Afrocentric theory incorporated into parts of this book, virtually everything began in Africa, and no matter what the point in question, Black Africans did it first. Of course, Jackson never embraced the theory in its extreme form, but his own status as an American pioneer in African studies and founder of one of the first academic programs in Afro-American studies made the blandishments of at least parts of Afrocentric theory irresistible. Luckily, even if we reject those questionable details of Christianity Before Christ, the general thesis of the book remains unshaken, namely, that nothing is new in Christianity. Its least important features, as well as its most important components, were all well developed in cultures that flourished well before the time that Christ is alleged to have walked the parched paths of Roman Palestine. The information presented in this book is absolutely crucial if atheists and other freethinkers are to understand the nature of the beast that threatens not only their liberties and rights as citizens in a secular republic, but also threatens to return world civilization itself back to the pre-scientific levels of the ancient cultures from which Christianity derived all its odd details. Every atheist needs to know what's in this book. Potentially one of the most important topics discussed in this book is found as Chapter 4, Bel, the Babylonian Christ. In this chapter, mention is made of a Babylonian tablet now in the British Museum that records a passion play in which the god Bel undergoes a trial, execution, and resurrection that is astonishingly similar in its details to the passion stories now found in the Christian New Testament. The Babylonian tablet is said to date from around 2000 before the Common Era, and it would appear that the Christian passion story is merely a late edition of the Babylonian drama. If it could be proved that something supposedly so unique and detailed as the Christian Passion Tale was merely an adaptation of a religious drama that was already over 2 millennia older than Christianity, the argument against the authenticity of Christianity could be strengthened several orders of magnitude. The notion that Jesus Christ was no more historical than Zeus, Osiris, Krishna, or Bel would be virtually proven. Unfortunately, since John G. Jackson, for all his brilliance, was not an Assyriologist who could read cuneiform tablets on his own, he had to rely on secondary or even tertiary sources for his discussion of this most tantalizing topic. More unfortunately, his only source for information concerning the Babylonian Passion Play is a book by J. Arthur Findlay, The Psychic Stream, or The Source and Growth of the Christian Faith. According to Findlay, the Babylonian Passion Play is based on a tablet discussed in the ruins of Babylon by Professor H. Zimmern, and the curator of the Babylonian section of the British Museum supplied him with a translation of the document. Now, a publication by the Psychic Press is not likely to inspire much confidence on the part of atheist scholars. Even so, it is unthinkable that Findlay simply made up the story, despite the fact that John G. Jackson appears to be the only other scholar to have examined it in 50 years. It is possible the story was just too hot for mainline scholars to handle. Because of the extreme importance of this question, I myself have tried to discover the facts concerning the Babylonian Passion Play. Almost certainly, the Professor H. Zimmern was Heinrich Zimmern, a German Assyriologist who lived from 1862 to 1931. Zimmern published a number of books that certainly might relate to the subject in question. His Babylonische Hymnen und Gebete, Babylonian Hymns and Prayers, two parts, 1905 and 1911, and his Vater, Sohn und Fürsprecher in der Babylonischen Gottesvorstellung, Father, Son, and Intercessor in the Babylonian Conception of God, Leipzig, 1896, might certainly be expected to contain some reference to the tablet in question. Even more tantalizingly, he authored a work entitled Zum Streit die Christumsmitte, The Christ Myth Controversy, relating to Arthur Drew's book Die Christumsmitte, The Christ Myth, a work arguing that Jesus was not an historical figure. Alas, as this book goes to press, I've been unable to obtain any of these rare books, and emails to the present curator of the Babylonian collection at the British Museum have gone unacknowledged as well as unanswered. If I am ever able to learn the truth about the Passion Play of Bell, I will add it to this foreword. Most likely, the information will warrant an entire book. Frank R. Zindler, editor, American Atheist Press, June 2002. About the author. John G. Jackson was an educator, lecturer, author, and a man of principle. He was born on April 1, 1907, into a family of Methodists. As he remembers now, he has been an atheist since he could think. The family minister once asked him when he was small, "Who made you?" After some thought, he replied from his own realization, "I don't know." He lived for 50 years in New York City, 1932 to 1977, lecturing at the Ingersoll Forum of the American Association for the Advancement of Atheism, from 1930 to 1955. During a parallel period, he wrote articles for the Truth Seeker magazine. He was at the same time a writer and associate of the Rationalist Press Association in London, England, from 1932 to 1972. Beginning in 1971, he became a lecturer in the Black Studies Department of Rutgers University, remaining there until 1973. From 1973 to 1977, he was a visiting professor at the University of New York. When he moved to Chicago, he quickly became a visiting professor at Northeast Illinois University from 1977 to 1980. One of the courses which he taught was Comparative Religion. His approach to that course was such that university officials cautioned him to be more discreet. Another of his courses dealt with social movements. Jackson was ever a consistent friend of labor and was a member of the UAW District 65 AFL-CIO for most of his life. His books include Introduction to African Civilizations, A Guide to the Study of African History, Ethiopia and the Origin of Civilization, Man, God, and Civilization, and best-selling Pagan Origins of the Christ Myth. Introduction. The title of this essay may appear to some to be paradoxical. They might ask, how could there be Christianity before Christ? The great African church father, St. Augustine, studied this question and answered as follows. That which is known as the Christian religion existed among the ancients and never did not exist. From the beginning of the human race until the time when Christ came in the flesh, at which time the true religion, which already existed, began to be called Christianity. This passage was followed by the appended commentary. This astonishing declaration was made in the early 4th century of our era. It can be asserted with little chance of refutation that if this affirmation of the pious Augustine had not sunk out of sight, but had been kept in open view through the period of Western history, the whole course of that history would have been vastly altered for the better. It is only too likely the case that the obvious implications of the passage were of such a nature that its open exploitation was designedly frowned upon by the ecclesiastical authorities in every age. It held the kernel of a great truth, the common knowledge of which would have been a stumbling block in the way of the perpetuation of priestly power over the general Christian mind. It would have provoked inquiry and disarmed the ecclesiastical prestige of much of its power. The commentary further stated, "For what is it that the Christian saint actually says? It stands as hardly less than a point-blank repudiation of all the chief asseverations on which the structure of Christian tradition rests. Every child born to Christian parents in 18 centuries has been indoctrinated with the unqualified belief that Christianity was completely new and the first true religion in world history, that it was vouchsafed to the world by God himself and brought to earth by the sole divine emissary ever commissioned to convey God's truth to mankind, that it flashed out amid the lingering murks of pagan darkness as the first ray of true light to illuminate the pathway of evolution for the safe treading of human feet. All previous religion was the superstitious product of primitive childishness of mind. Christianity was the first piercing of the long night of black heathenism by the benignant gift of God." Finally, the commentary stated, "Augustine shatters this illusion and this jealously preserved phantom of blind credulity. From remotest antiquity, he asserts, there has always existed in the world the true religion. It illuminated the intellects of the most ancient sages, prophets, priests, and kings. It built the foundation for every national religion, the tenets of which consisted of reformulation of its ubiquitous, ageless principles of knowledge and wisdom. It went under a variety of designations: Hermeticism in ancient Egypt, Orphism in early Greece, Zoroastrianism in Persia, Brahmanism in India, Taoism in China, Shintoism in Japan and China. In no matter what garbled and perverted form, even tribal religionism fostered it. Mystery cultism dramatized and ritualized it in many lands. Social usages, all the round of annual festivals, chimney corner tale and castle ballad, countryside legend and folklore carried it down the stream of time. Always it existed among men. Never was it not present in the world. Hardly ever apprehended at its real value, its representations badly misconceived, its import warped and travestied at every turn in popular practice, it yet existed and came down to Augustine's day." There is an extensive literature on the pagan origins of Christianity. Most of these works, written by scholars for scholars, never reach the general reader. Students of comparative religion are familiar with such books as Bible Myths and Their Parallels in Other Religions by T.W. Doan, The Golden Bough and Folklore in the Old Testament by Sir James G. Fraser, Pagan and Christian Creeds by Edward Carpenter, Anacalypsis by Godfrey Higgins, Ancient Egypt, The Light of the World by Gerald Massey, The Signs and Symbols of Primordial Man by Dr. Albert Churchward, and Did Jesus Live 100 BC? By G.R.S. Mead. Most of these books are out of print or difficult to obtain by laymen who are interested in this field of study. So, the purpose of this treatise is to popularize the results of the research of the great scholars named, and a few others whom we will meet as we proceed in this study. Chapter 1. The Creation of the World and of Man. Archbishop James Usher, in 1630, announced that the world was created by God in the year 4004 BC. This date has been accepted by large numbers of Orthodox Christians. A more precise estimate of the age of the earth was made by Dr. John Lightfoot, 1602 to 1675, Vice Chancellor of the University of Cambridge, who declared that heaven and earth, center and circumference, were created all together in the same instant. This work took place, and man was created by the Trinity, on October 23, 4004 BC, at 9 o'clock in the morning. This estimate was widely accepted for about 200 years. Then grave doubts were cast upon it by discoveries made in the Nile Valley and in Western Asia, as a great American historian noted. Within 2 centuries after Lightfoot's great biblical demonstration to the exact hour of creation, it was discovered that at that hour, an exceedingly cultivated people, enjoying all the fruits of a highly developed civilization, had long been swarming in the great cities of Egypt, and that other nations hardly less advanced had at that time reached a high development in Asia. During the Middle Ages, the Christian God was anthropomorphic. As Professor White observed, among those masses of cathedral sculpture which preserve so much of medieval theology, one frequently recurring group is noteworthy for its presentment of a time-honored doctrine regarding the origin of the universe. The Almighty, in human form, sits benignly, making the sun, moon, and stars, and hanging them from the solid firmament which supports the heaven above and overarches the earth beneath. The furrows of thought on the Creator's brow show that in this work he is obliged to contrive. The knotted muscles upon his arms show that he is obliged to toil. Naturally, they, the sculptors and painters of the medieval and early modern period, frequently represented him as the writers whose conceptions they embodied had done. As on the seventh day, weary after thought and toil, enjoying well-earned repose and the plaudits of the hosts of heaven. There are 2 stories of the creation of man in Genesis, one in chapter 1 and the other in chapter 2. These 2 accounts flatly contradict each other, and this has created a problem for true believers. We learn from the first 3 verses of Genesis chapter 1 that after God created the heavens and the earth, he gave the command, "Let there be light," and there was light. Then the light was called day, and the darkness, night. This completed the first day's work. The second day's work was the creation of the firmament. In the 3rd day, God brought forth the dry land, which he called the earth, and the waters, called the seas. Then the earth was made to produce grass, trees, etc. Thus ended the 3rd day of creation. Next, the sun and moon were created and set in the firmament by God. This ended the 4th day. On the next day, God created great whales and other water animals, and also winged fowl. This concluded the work of the 5th day. The 6th day completed the work of creation. God made all sorts of beasts, cattle, creeping things, and finally man, whom he created male and female in his own image. On the 7th day, God rested from his labors, and the day was blessed and sanctified as the Sabbath. In this first narrative, God is said to have created the lower animals first, and then later on, human beings, both male and female. In the 2nd account, we are told that God created man first, the lower animals next, and last of all, woman, who was made from a rib extracted from man. In the 1st story, the Creator begins with fishes, then produces in turn birds and beasts, and finally man and woman. In the 2nd tale, man comes first, and God then makes the lower animals, and finally woman. The most noticeable points of difference between the 2 cosmogonies are: 1. In the 1st, the earth emerged from the waters and was hence saturated with moisture. In the 2nd, the whole face of the ground required moistening. 2. In the 1st, the birds and beasts were created before man. In the 2nd, man was created before the birds and beasts. 3. In the 1st, all flying fowl were made from the waters. In the 2nd, the fowl of the air were made out of the ground. 4. In the 1st, man was made in the image of God. In the 2nd, man was made from dust and then animated with the breath of life. After the eating of the forbidden fruit by the 1st human pair, the Lord God said, "Behold, the man has become as one of us to know good and evil." 5. In the 1st, man was made lord of the whole earth. In the 2nd, he was placed in the Garden of Eden only, to dress it and keep it. 6. In the 1st, the man and woman were created together as the closing work of the creation. In the second, man was created, then the birds and beasts, and lastly, the woman was made from a rib of the man. The discrepancies pointed out here are due to the fact that the first and second accounts were taken from two different documents. In the first narrative, the creator is called Elohim, God, whereas in the second, he is called Jehovah Elohim, Lord God. This fact was well expressed by Fraser as follows. The flagrant contradiction between the two accounts is explained very simply by the circumstance that they are derived from two different and originally independent documents, which were afterwards combined into a single book by an editor, who pieced the two narratives together without always taking pains to soften or harmonize their discrepancies. The account of the creation in the first chapter is derived from what is called the priestly document, which was composed by priestly writers during or after the Babylonian captivity. The account of the creation of man and the animals in the second chapter is derived from what is called the Jehovistic document, which was written several hundred years before the other, probably in the 9th or 8th century before our era. There are numerous parallels to the Genesis stories in the mythologies of many ancient peoples, and I shall briefly recount a few of them for purposes of comparison. The Jehovistic story told of how God fashioned the first man of clay, as a potter might do. Then, having kneaded the model into proper shape, the deity animated it with his breath. The first man was called Adam. In the ancient Hebrew language, the word for man was Adam. The word for ground was Adama. So, man was derived from the ground, or earth. Among the Shaluks of the White Nile in Africa, there is a myth explaining the various complexions of the human race. Juwak, the creator, traveled over the world. He made black men out of black earth in the land of the Shaluks. In Egypt, he made brown men out of the mud of the Nile. Out of white earth, he made white men, and so on. Juwak went about his creative work by taking a lump of earth and saying, "I will make man, but he must be able to walk and run and go out into the fields, so I will give him two long legs, like the flamingo. The man must be able to cultivate his millet, so I will give him two arms, one to hold the hoe and the other to tear up the weeds. The man must be able to see his millet, so I will give him two eyes. The man must be able to eat his millet, so I will give him a mouth. The man must be able to dance and speak and sing and shout, and for these purposes he must have a tongue. The man must be able to hear the noise of the dance and the speech of great men, and for that he needs two ears." So the creator acted accordingly, finished his task, and sent the first man out into the world. In the Egyptian creation myths, we're told that the universe came out of a cosmic egg. In the version known at Memphis in Egypt, Ptah, the opener, broke the egg from which the sun and moon came forth. At Elephantine, the creation of the world was attributed to Khnum, who molded the first man out of the mud of the Nile, like a potter working with his wheel. It's interesting to note that Ptah was the god of the North Pole, and that Khnum, or Khnumen, or Khnumu, was the god of the South Pole, and that each of these divinities was associated with seven associate gods. In the case of Ptah, these minor deities were said to have been his sons. Our supposition is that since Ptah represents the pole of the heavens, his seven sons stand for seven successive positions of the pole brought about by procession. As to the South Polar god, we learn from the same authority that Khnumen was called builder of men, maker of the gods, the father from the beginning, creator of things which are or shall be, etc. He supported the heavens upon its four pillars in the beginning. The earth, air, sea, and sky are his handiwork. Our idea is that Khnumen is the divinity of the South Pole and contemporary with Ptah. The axis on which the universe turned had two pivots, and the southern god contributed to the work of creation as much as the northern god. We are told that Khnumen labored with Ptah in carrying out the work of creation ordered by Thoth, and again that Ptah was assisted in his work by the seven Khnumen, or architects. We remember the seven sons of Ptah. Ptah had modeled men with his own hands, and Khnumen had formed them on a potter's table. At Philae and at Dendera, Ptah is represented as piling upon his potter's table the plastic clay from which he is about to make a human body. Khnumen is sometimes represented as molding the egg of the universe out of the matter furnished by Ptah. The Babylonians, according to Berossus, a priest of Bel at Babylon, circa 250 BC, believed that the god Bel cut off his own head and that the other gods collected his blood and, mixing it with the earth, made men out of the paste, which explains why men are so wise, since their bodies are animated by the blood of a god. A similar tale was current in ancient Greece, where Prometheus created men and beasts out of clay. When he had done his work, some of the clay was left over and might be seen on the spot long afterwards in the shape of two large boulders lying at the edge of a ravine. A Greek traveler who visited the place in the 2nd century of our era thought that the boulders had the color of clay and that they smelt strongly of human flesh. This act of creation by Prometheus was said to have occurred at Panopeus. I, too, visited the spot some 1,750 years later, we are told by Fraser. It is a forlorn little glen, or rather hollow, on the southern side of the hill of Panopeus, below the long line of ruined but still stately walls and towers which crowns the gray rocks of the summit. It was a hot day in late autumn, the 1st of November, and after the long rainless summer of Greece, the little glen was quite dry. No water trickled down its bushy sides, but in the bottom I found a reddish, crumbling earth, perhaps a relic of the clay out of which Prometheus modeled our first parents. A creation myth of the Maoris of New Zealand records how the god Tiki mixed some of his own blood with red clay and modeled a man in his own image. The model was animated by the god breathing into his mouth and nose, causing the effigy to come alive and sneeze. This first man was called Tiki Ahua, Tiki's likeness. In Tahiti, the first human couple were made by the god Taharoa. After creating the world, the god made the first man out of red earth. Then he put the man to sleep, and after extracting from him a bone, Ivi, fashioned it into a woman. This story was recorded for posterity by the missionary William Ellis, who declared that this always appeared to me a mere recital of the Mosaic account of creation, which they had heard from some European, and I never placed any reliance on it, although they have repeatedly told me it was a tradition among them before any foreigner arrived. Some have also stated that the woman's name was Ivi, which would be by them pronounced as if written Eve. Ivi is an aboriginal word, and not only signifies a bone, but also a widow and a victim slain in war. Notwithstanding the assertion of the natives, I am disposed to think that Ivi, or Eve, is the only aboriginal part of the story, as far as it respects the mother of the human race. The opinion of the missionary was probably erroneous, for similar myths are current throughout Polynesia. In Bowditch Island, there is a tradition that after the creator god made the first man, he then from earth produced the image of the woman, who immediately began to live. He then placed the happy pair in an earthly paradise, where, free from care and toil, they could live on the sweet fruits of a delightful garden, where birds and beasts frisked about them in fearless security. As a crowning mercy, he planned for our first parents the great gift of immortality, but resolved to make them arbiters of their own fate by leaving them free to accept or reject the proffered boon. For that purpose, he planted in the midst of the garden two wondrous trees that bore fruits of very different sorts, the fruit of the one being fraught with death to the eater, and the other with life eternal. Having done so, he sent the serpent to the man and woman and charged him to deliver this message: "Eat not of the tree of death, for in the day ye eat thereof, ye shall surely die. But eat of the tree of life, and live forever." Now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field, and on his way he bethought him of changing the message. So when he came to the happy garden and found the woman alone in it, he said to her, "Thus saith God, eat not of the tree of life, for in the day ye eat thereof, ye shall surely die. But eat of the tree of death, and live forever." The foolish woman believed him, and ate of the fatal fruit, and gave it to her husband, and he ate also. But the sly serpent himself ate of the tree of life. That is why men have been mortal and serpents immortal ever since. For serpents cast their skins every year, and so renew their youth. If only the serpent had not perverted God's good message and deceived our first mother, we should have been immortal instead of the serpents. For like the serpents, we should cast our skins every year, and so renew our youth perpetually. The myths of the origin of death are based on two original stories. One, the story of the perverted message, and two, the story of the cast skin. Later mythologists combined the two original stories into the composite story of the perverted message and the cast skin. These myths seem to have originated in Africa, but they were told all over the world in ancient times, and I shall cite a few examples. A good example of the story of the perverted message survives among the Manakwas of South Africa. These people associate the phases of the moon with the idea of immortality. Once upon a time, they say the moon wished to make mankind immortal, and the hare was entrusted with the message and was instructed to say, "As I die and rise to life again, so shall you die and rise to life again." The hare, either through forgetfulness or just plain carelessness, reversed the moon's message, saying, "As I die and do not rise to life again, so shall you also die and not rise to life again." On learning of the hare's perversion of her message, the moon hurled a stick at the animal, which, hitting him, split his lip. This explains the cloven lip of the hare. A Namaqua elder stated that, "We are still enraged with the hare because he brought such a bad message, and we will not eat him." So, even to this day, when youths become of age among the Namaquas, they are forbidden to partake of the flesh of a hare. A violation of this taboo may involve banishment from the community. The Nandi of East Africa trace the origin of death to the ill will of a certain dog. In the early ages of the world, this dog appeared to a group of people and said, "All people will die like the moon, but unlike the moon, you will not return to life again unless you give me some milk to drink out of your gourd and beer to drink through your straw. If you do this, I will arrange for you to go to the river when you die, and to come to life again on the third day." The dog was laughed at by the people, who gave him milk and beer to drink off a stool. The dog resented not receiving the kind of service he requested, and then said, "All people will die, and the moon alone will return to life." This explains why when people die, they stay dead, while the moon dies and then comes back to life after 3 days. In this story, Fraser comments, nothing is said as to the personage who sent the dog with the message of immortality to men, but from the messenger's reference to the moon and from a comparison with the parallel Hottentot story, we may reasonably infer that it was the moon who employed the dog to run the errand, and that the unscrupulous animal misused his opportunity to extort privileges for himself to which he was not strictly entitled. In some of the myths of the origin of death, two messengers are involved. For instance, there's a Hottentot story in which the couriers are an insect and a hare. The moon, it is said, told an insect to go to men and announce from the moon that, "As I die and dying live, so ye shall also die and dying live." The insect started on his errand but was halted by a hare. "On what errand are you bound?" the hare asked. The insect replied, "I am sent by the moon to men to tell them that as she dies and dying lives, they also shall die and dying live." The hare then replied, "As you are an awkward runner, let me go." So the hare ran swiftly while the insect followed at a leisurely pace. Coming to the men, the hare proclaimed he had a message from the moon, namely, "As I die and dying perish, in the same manner, you shall also die and come wholly to an end." The hare then went to the moon and told of how he had perverted her message. The moon angrily denounced the hare for his perfidy and whacked him on the nose with a stick, causing a slit in the nose, and this is why hares ever since have been afflicted with slit noses. The Masarwas, another South African people, tell a similar tale. In this case, the moon sent the tortoise with the glad tidings to men, but the tortoise dawdled along and kept repeating the message to himself so as not to forget it. This irked the moon, So she called the hare and said, "Since you are a swift runner, tell the men that as I dying live again, so they dying will live again." The hare also had a bad memory, so getting to the men announced the moon's message thusly. "As I dying live again, so you dying will die forever." The tortoise, following the hare, finally arrived and gave the right message, but, alas, he was too late. The men were angry at the hare for bringing them the wrong message, and as the hare sat nibbling grass, one of the men bounced a stone off the animal's mouth, splitting the upper lip. That is why hares have a cleft upper lip. There are Ashanti versions of this myth in which the messengers were a sheep and a goat. According to these stories, in ancient days, God visited his children and talked with them. On one occasion, God looked on while some women were stirring a batch of mash in a mortar with pestles. This annoyed the women, and they told God to get lost, and meanwhile beat him with their pestles. So God went back to heaven and ceased visiting the world, but he bore no ill will to people. So one day he sent a goat to men with the message, "There is something which they call death. He will kill some of you. But even if you die, you will not perish completely. You will come to me in heaven." The goat started out to convey this intelligence, but stopped on the way to browse on a bush. God looked down from heaven and noticed the loitering goat. A sheep was then dispatched with the same message and told to go without delay. The sheep, afflicted with amnesia, hurriedly arrived and told the people, "God sends you word that you will die, and that will be the end of you." The goat later arrived and gave the correct message, but the men replied, "No, goat, that is not what God said. We believe that the message which the sheep brought us is the one which God sent to us." In another Ashanti version of this myth, the roles of the messengers are reversed, with the sheep setting out to bring the glad tidings of immortality to men. However, the goat overtook the sheep and got to men first, and informed them they were mortal. In these tales, the origin of death was ascribed to the error or deceit of one of the two messengers. There are, however, other versions current among the Bantus of Africa, in which God was responsible for man's loss of immortality. In these tales, God is said to have decided to let death prevail. According to a Zulu myth, in the early days of the world, Unkulunkulu, the old, old one, sent a chameleon with a message to men. "Go, chameleon, go and say, let not men die." The chameleon crawled along and stopped on the way to eat mulberries. The old, old one sent the lizard with another message. "Lizards, when you have arrived, say, let men die." The lizard got there first and delivered his message. Then later the chameleon showed up and said, "It is said, let not men die." But the men replied, "We have heard the word of the lizard. We cannot hear your word. Through the word of the lizard, men will die." The same or a similar story is told among other Bantus, such as the Basutos, Bechuanas, Baronga, and the Ngoni. The same tale in a slightly different form is current among the Hausas of West Africa. We may conclude with Sir J. G. Fraser. "Thus, the belief is widespread in Africa that God at one time purposed to make mankind immortal, but that the benevolent scheme miscarried through the fault of the messenger to whom he entrusted the gospel message." The story of the cast skin is based on the belief that certain animals, particularly serpents, periodically cast their skins and, renewing their youth, do not die. Primitive men who believed this made up myths to explain why certain animals became immortal and why mankind remained mortal. The Wabende and the Wafipa of East Africa tell of how the creator god Leza one day visited the world and said to all living creatures, "Who wishes not to die?" All other animals and man, except the serpent, were asleep, and they did not hear the question. The serpent alone, being awake, heard and replied, "I do." So that is why men and other animals die while the serpent crawls out of his old skin and, outfitted with a new skin, perpetually renews his youth. The serpent can only meet death by being killed. The Dusuns of North Borneo have preserved a similar tradition. The Creator, after making the world and all things in it, then announced, "Who is able to cast off his skin? If anyone can do so, he shall not die." Only the snake heard this proclamation, and he promptly answered, "I can." Similar beliefs were not unknown in the New World. The Arawaks of British Guiana told of how the Creator came to Earth to see how his human children were getting along. Men were so evil that they tried to kill the Creator, so he rendered them mortal and gave eternal life to animals capable of casting their skins, such as beetles, lizards, and serpents. Another version of this myth has been preserved by the Tamanchirs of the Orinoco. The Creator, after residing with them for some time, embarked on a boat to cross the ocean. On leaving the shore, he announced, "You will change your skins," meaning, "You will renew your youth like beetles and snakes." An old woman hearing these words remarked sarcastically, "Oh." The Creator, greatly annoyed, then said, "You shall die." And that, of course, is why mankind became mortal. In the early ages of the world, life and death were believed to have some connection with the phases of the moon. This doctrine of lunar sympathy was subscribed to by the Mantras of the Malay Peninsula. Men in most ancient times did not die, but they grew thin as the moon wanes and became fat as the lunar orb waxes to full phase. This caused a population explosion since nobody was dying. A son of the first man called this fact to the attention of his father and asked him what should be done about it. The first man answered, "Leave things the way they are." A younger brother of the son of the first man dissented, saying, "No, let men die like the banana, leaving their offspring behind." Finally, the question was submitted to the Lord of the Underworld, who decided in favor of death. So, men ceased renewing their youth like the moon, and began to die like the banana. The inhabitants of the Caroline Islands believed that, in days of old, people died on the last day of the waning moon, and came to life again at the appearance of the new moon. But an evil spirit intervened and arranged things so that once people were dead, they remained in that condition. The Kaitish of Central Australia had a tradition that in the early days, men were either buried underground or in trees, and that after 3 days, they invariably arose from the dead. This congenial state of affairs was ended by the conduct of a man of the Curlew totem, who, seeing two members of the Little Wallaby totem engaged in burying a brother of the clan, proceeded to seize the corpse and kick it into the sea. Since that event, nobody rose from the dead, and this is why nobody today rises from the dead after 3 days, as everybody did in the days of the remote past. Nothing is said about the moon in the aforesaid story of the origin of death, but we may logically infer that the 3 days men of yore remained dead were the 3 days in which the light of the moon was invisible. In many of these myths pretending to account for the origin of death, the animal responsible for bringing death to mankind was the lizard. This is especially the case in many of the African traditions. In many African tales, Fraser noted, "The instrument of bringing death among men is the lizard." We may conjecture that the reason for assigning the invidious office to a lizard was that this animal, like the serpent, casts its skin periodically, from which primitive man might infer, as he infers with regard to serpents, that the creature renews its youth and lives forever. Thus, all the myths which relate to how a lizard or a serpent became the maleficent agent of human mortality may perhaps be referred to an old idea of a certain jealousy and rivalry between men and creatures which cast their skins, notably serpents and lizards. We may suppose that in all such cases, a story was told of a contest between man and his animal rivals for the possession of immortality, a contest in which, whether by mistake or guile, the victory always remained with the animals, who thus became immortal, while mankind was doomed to mortality. We must now consider the composite story of the perverted message and the cast skin. Such a myth has been preserved by the Galas of East Africa. This tradition attempted to explain the immortality of serpents and the mortality of men. It seems that God sent a certain bird, dark blue or black in color, bearing a white mark on each wing and a crest on its head. This bird had been told to announce to men that when they had reached a state of senility, they would cast their skins and thus renew their youth. The bird started out to deliver the glad tidings, but on the way observed a snake eating carrion. The bird then said to the serpent that he would give him God's message if he, the snake, would share his meal with him. The snake said that he was not interested in hearing God's message, but the bird talked him around, and the reptile was given the following message. When men grow old, they will die, but when you grow old, you will cast your skin and renew your youth. The story of the fall of man in the third chapter of Genesis seems to be an abridged edition of the numerous primitive myths dealing with the origin of death. Fraser concluded that little is wanted to complete its resemblance to the similar myths still told by savages in many parts of the world. The principal, almost the only omission, is the silence of the narrator as to the eating of the fruit of the tree of life by the serpent and the consequent attainment of immortality by the reptile. Nor is it difficult to account for the lacuna. The vein of rationalism, which runs through the Hebrew account of creation and has stripped it of many grotesque features that adorn or disfigure the corresponding Babylonian tradition, could hardly fail to find a stumbling block in the alleged immortality of serpents. And the redactor of the story in its final form has removed this stone of offense from the path of the faithful by the simple process of blotting out the incident entirely from the legend. Yet the yawning gap left by his sponge has not escaped the commentators, who look in vain for the part which should have been played in the narrative by the tree of life. If my interpretation of the story is right, it has been left for the comparative method, after thousands of years, to supply the blank in the ancient canvas, and to restore, in all their primitive crudity, the gay barbaric colors which the skillful hand of the Hebrew artist has softened or effaced. All of the great nations of the ancient world had inherited creation myths similar to those recorded in the Bible from their primitive ancestors. I shall examine only a few representative examples as concisely as possible. 1. Egyptian. A god dwelling in a primeval abyss, where he had been since the beginning of time, uttered his own name, and by so doing, caused himself to live. B. This god then created by magic a foundation on which to stand, probably the earth. C. From his mouth, this god drew forth objects which reproduced themselves. D. He then created two other gods, male and female, who in turn propagated other gods. E. Next, vegetation and creeping things were created on the earth. F. Man was finally created from the tears falling from the eyes of the original god. 2. Babylonian. A. There were primeval gods dwelling in an abyss. B. Other gods joined them later, and a conflict developed. C. Two of the primeval deities were slain. Another god, a female, created monsters and fought against the newly arrived gods, but was eventually killed. D. The new gods created the heavens and the earth from the body of the slain goddess. E. One of the gods was decapitated, and from his blood and bones, the first human beings were derived. 3. Chinese. A. The world started as an atom formed from nothing. B. Over vast periods of time, the original atom split in two, producing a male and a female principle. These also split in two, eventually into four elements. C. From the four elements, a being was produced, whose body produced the constituents of the universe, and from whose decomposing corpse came worms, which eventually became human beings. 4. Japanese. A. The world started from an atom, which produced male and female elements. B. These formed an egg, containing germs from which heaven and earth resulted. C. A species of reed shoot grew up between heaven and earth, and then changed into a god. D. Living beings were then born, and two of them united, giving birth to seas, rivers, islands, trees, herbs, and the various heavenly bodies. 5. Celtic. A. The world was brought about by two principles, one creative, the other destructive. B. The destructive principle dwelled in an abyss. C. Life in an atomic form was created by the spoken words of the creative principle. D. Man originated in the abyss, then came to the earth. 6. Scandinavian. A. In the beginning was a yawning abyss, bordered on one side by mist and cold, and on the other side by fire. B. A spark from the fire melted some cold vapor, producing a giant. C. This giant then gave birth to a race of giants. D. The original giant had a cow which, by licking a brine-covered rock, produced the father of the gods. E. Other gods were engendered, and they in turn slew the giant and created the world from his body. F. The earth, covered with water, was lifted out of it by the gods. G. Finally, two figures were formed from trees and were given life and understanding by the gods. The myths and legends concerning the creation of the universe, of the world, and of man related in the Bible were widely believed by many educated people up to the beginning of the Age of Enlightenment in the 18th century. Since then, evolution has triumphed, and science has superseded superstition to a considerable extent. With the rise of the science of Egyptology, the biblical chronology of Usher and Lightfoot was completely demolished. The ancient records of Egypt show that by the year 4004 BC, supposedly the date of the beginning of the world, the Great Pyramid had already been built and had been used by the astronomers of Egypt as an observatory over long periods of time. Even before the rise of the culture of Egypt, there was the great Kushite or Ethiopian civilization, which was widespread in both Africa and Asia. One of the greatest African Ethiopian temples was located at Abu Simbel or Ipsambul in Nubia. When an English traveler named Wilson visited this temple, he saw sculptured on its walls the story of the fall of man as told in Genesis. Adam and Eve were shown in the Garden of Eden, as well as the tempting serpent and the fatal tree. Commenting on this fact, Godfrey Higgins asked, "How is the fact of the mythos of the second book of Genesis being found in Nubia, probably 1,000 miles above Heliopolis, to be accounted for?" Higgins then added that the same mythos is found in India. For evidence, he cited Colonel Todd's History of Rajputana as follows. A drawing brought by Colonel Coombs from a sculptured column in a cave temple in the south of India represents the first pair at the foot of the ambrosial tree, and a serpent entwined among the heavily laden boughs, presenting to them some of the fruit from his mouth. The ancient peoples of India were Asiatic Ethiopians, and it should not surprise us that they shared common traditions with their brothers in Africa. The scriptural record of the creation of the world confines it to the period of 6 days. Other ancient speculations were more liberal. The Indo-Persian system of Zoroaster, for instance, represented the creation as taking place over a time of 6,000 years. This chronology, as reproduced by Busenbark, is 1,000 years, creation of the sky, 2,000 years, creation of the water, 3,000 years, creation of the earth, 4,000 years, creation of the planets, 5,000 years, creation of the animals, 6,000 years, creation of man. The stories in Genesis tell of a flat earth, which was apparently the center of the universe, with the world stationary and the sun moving around it. The priests of ancient Egypt would have laughed at this crude cosmogony, for they had much more advanced knowledge in this field. An ancient Egyptian account of the origin of the world has been translated by Dr. Churchward as follows. Then God sent forth his edict to each one of the sons and commanded them to emit worlds, and every sun that was in the universe sent forth from his bosom a choir of planets. Thus began the solar system that exists, each sun being the center of the planets which he evolved, and every planet revolving about that center from whose glowing bosom he had birth. Many and various were the planets evolved according to the nature of the suns from which they came, according also to the manifold existences which God foresaw would be produced thenceforth. When the planets were evolved from the sun, they were sent forth at first in gaseous vapor, immense revolving spheres projected into space, but bound by laws in the parent star. When this vapor subsided and condensed, they became mighty spheres of water, whirling along their regulated paths. When ages and ages rolled into the gulfs of ages and ages, and ages vanished into the abyss of time, the sphere became solidified with earthly particles and ceased to be a watery globe. And thus, as years revolved on years, and the forces of nature exercised their powers, and heat contended with cold and vapor with solid, there were volcanic changes and fiery revolutions and many deluges. Then the earth gradually assumed its present shape, having been the grave of successive generations, until the race that now exists upon it assumed unto themselves living developments. The advanced mathematical and astronomical knowledge possessed by the Egyptian scientists in the Pyramid Age, more than 6,000 years ago, has been largely ignored by contemporary scholars, so I shall touch upon it briefly. A good summary of some of this suppressed knowledge has been given by Professor Stikini in the following passage. Information about the Egyptian estimate of the size and shape of the earth is provided by Chapter 64 of the Book of the Dead. In one of the papyri of the Book of the Dead, there is an annotation to the effect that this chapter was found in the shrine of the solar boat during the reign of Udimu, the fourth or fifth pharaoh of the first dynasty. Chapter 64 states that the spirits of the netherworld, that is, all that is below the surface of the earth, are 4,601,200, and that each is 12 cubits high. The occurrence of the factor 12 indicates that is a matter of geographic cubits. Now, 12 times 4,601,200 cubits equals 55,214,000 cubits equals 138,036 geographic stadia is equal to two diameters of the earth. In order to explain the figure 138,036 stadia, one must assume that the Egyptians reckoned as if the polar flattening occurs only in the northern hemisphere. On the basis of this assumption, the figure of 138,036 stadia can be decomposed into the following Earth radii. 34,538 stadia equals 6,378,388 meters equals equatorial radius, plus 34,538 stadia plus 34,538 stadia plus 34,422 stadia equals 6,356,966 meters equals polar radius equals 138,036 stadia. These figures imply that the flattening of the North Pole is 116 over 34,538 equals 1 over 297.74. With extreme economy of numerical expression, the Egyptians had arrived at values which are as good as the best modern ones. I believe that a summary of the evidence adduced by modern science relating to the origin of the world, the story of cosmic, organic, and social evolution, and of man and his works, should be of value to the reader, and this information is tabulated next. Evolution, a summary. Origin of the world, 10 billion years ago. Origin of life, 2 billion years ago. First vertebrates, fish, 400 million years ago. Amphibians, 300 million years ago. Reptiles, 270 million years ago. Birds and mammals, 150 million years ago. Apes, 40 million years ago. Man branched off from ape ancestors in Africa about 25 million years ago. First true men appeared in Africa from 2,500,000 to 5 million years ago. First civilization in Africa at least 20,000 years ago. Among the early civilizations were those of the Pygmies, Ethiopians, Egyptians, Mesopotamians, Minoans, Dravidians, Olmecs, Mayans, Aztecs, Incans, mound builders, etc. Chapter 2, The Great Deluge. We're all familiar with the story of the flood as given in Holy Writ. We recall that the first man and woman were created in a state of perfection, but that they soon fell from grace and were expelled from Eden. Mankind went downward rapidly. The first murder occurred in the first family, when Cain slew Abel. We're told that Cain fled to the land of Nod and took unto himself a wife. This story has been embarrassing to true believers, for according to Scripture, Adam and Eve and their two sons were the only people in the world at that time. As mankind waxed in wickedness, the good Lord finally decided to take steps through the proper channels. And here is the story as given in the Sacred Anthology. And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. And the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, and the creeping things, and the fowls of the air, for it repenteth me that I have made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. And God said unto Noah, The end of all flesh is come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Make thee an ark of gopher wood. Room shalt thou make in the ark, a window shalt thou make in the ark. And behold, I do bring a flood of waters upon the earth, to destroy all flesh wherein is the breath of life from under heaven, and everything that is in the earth shall die. But with thee shall I establish my covenant, and thou shalt come into the ark, thou and thy sons, and thy wife, and thy sons' wives, with thee. And of every living thing of all flesh, two of every sort shall thou bring into the ark, to keep them alive with thee. They shall be male and female. Of fowls after their kind, and of cattle after their kind, of every creeping thing of the earth after his kind, two of every sort shall come into thee, to keep them alive. And take thou unto thee of all food that is eaten, and thou shalt gather it to thee, and it shall be for food for thee and for them. Thus did Noah, according to all that God had commanded him. This passage is from the 6th chapter of Genesis. In Genesis chapter 7, verses 1-3, we read that after the ark had been completed, the Lord said to Noah, Come thou and all thy house into the ark. Of every clean beast thou shalt take to thee by sevens, the male and his female, and of beasts that are not clean by two, the male